To a call of the chair, we have now resumed our, well, actually, we're just starting our session, aren't we? We never did.
Who's on first?
So we have Representative Edgemond, Seaton, Roses, Wilson, co-chair Johnson, co-chair Gatto. We have Anthony Scott, and Anthony was born in Rome. The name comes from Shakespeare. How about that for setting you off on the wrong foot?
There you go.
But I was intrigued by it all. This is more Italian than I am. Can you believe that? That's a great presentation for us. I'm so looking forward to it. And ground rules, shut off your cell phones. Number two is, as you speak, occasionally we'll interrupt. Because of timelines, we're going to have to adjourn in 2 hours. So if you have a streamlined questions, that's just fine. If you have long questions, then it's probably less fine. Because we just want to make sure we're done by 6. He has a plane to catch, and 6 is not even close enough. But I guess it is close enough, but only just so. So, Mr. Scott, thank you very much. Welcome to Resources. Please proceed while I get a napkin.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Anthony Scott. I'm a commercial analyst in the Division of Oil and Gas, part of Department of Natural Resources. Presenting for you today a version of a presentation I gave in Senate Judiciary, which is in response to a number of questions that the chairman there had asked me, at trying to provide an economic context for the question of providing fiscal certainty on the project and the appropriate period of time for fiscal certainty, again, from an economic investment perspective. So that's the background to how this got framed up. I'm at your disposal and happy to answer questions on this and other matters. So in this presentation, I'm going to do a couple of things. The first is present producer returns on this project, both from their perspective only as shippers, also from the perspective of if they both own the pipeline and are shippers and need to make the necessary upstream investments. Then we'll go on and talk about the context of the investment measures in terms of the producer's other worldwide investment opportunities. Where does the Alaska project fit in terms of its relative attractiveness compared to other opportunities? And then finally, I'll talk about the importance of fiscal certainty again from an economic perspective and put it in context, the risk of fiscal uncertainty in context of other risks that the project faces. These are some terms I'm going to be using today. First is net present value. Net present value is just the current value of a stream of future cash flows. Cash flows in the future are not valued the same as cash flows today, so we discount them, not only to account for inflation, but also to account for impatience and risk. Cash flows 20 years in the future are less certain than cash flows tomorrow.
I'm sorry, I just didn't hear the word before, and risks.
Yes. We and companies discount future cash flows by what's called a discount rate. And the discount rate reflects not only inflation, but also is a measure of impatience. I'd rather have my cake today than tomorrow.
I thought it was the term that I...
Yeah, no, impatience.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd rather eat it now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Scientific term.
There you go. In terms of investments, one does not have a capital constraint, that is, if one can invest in any project that's available to one, You'll do so for all projects that have a net present value greater than zero, because those are projects that add value to the company. Clearly, the discount rate is important in choosing, is an important factor. What we're generally using here in this presentation and for this analysis is a discount rate of 10%. Next measure of investment attractiveness is the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is basically solving for the discount rate that makes the net present value of a project's cash flow equal to zero. Bigger numbers in general are better. Next, profitability index. This is basically a measure of the present value of cash inflows. Again, present value, that means discounted, divided by the present value of cash outflows. So for example, profitability index of 2 means if you invest a single dollar in the project, you get $2 of profit back.
Anthony, I need to interrupt you for a second. We have not yet introduced the people on the committee. So present Representative Edgemond, Coring, Seaton, Kawasaki, Roses, Wilson, Johnson, and Gatto. Thank you. Go ahead.
Finally, net present value per barrel oil equivalent. This is just taking the net present value and dividing by the undiscounted total barrel oil equivalent off the project. I have, for your reference, given you an excellent primer that was prepared by your consultant, Econ One, about a year ago, that goes through all of these investment measures, explains them in more detail, and helps explain their relative use, their relative meaning one against another. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this further, but you've got a really excellent primer if you want to read up more about how companies make decisions and how they the relative importance of each of these measures in their investment decision making. On slide 3, what report here are net present value with a discount rate of 10%, internal rate of return, profitability index, and NPV per BOE for a project which costs $20 billion roughly. This is a project into Alberta. It's a 4.3 BCF a day pipeline into Alberta. The assumptions behind all of these numbers are provided as an appendix at the very back, the last page of the presentation, so you can look those up if you're interested. What we see here is that at a $4 real gas price, the net present value, that is today's value of the project to the producers collectively, discounted at 10%, is $6.1 billion. At a $5.50 gas price, again, real price, the net present value of the project to the producers collectively is more than $12 billion. We're looking at corresponding internal rates of return of nearly 40 and over 60%. Profitability index, profitability ratios of 4.3 and 7.5. Is there a question?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, just to clarify, NPV 10.
Yes.
That means that you're taking the future profits and you're saying discounting it by 10% each year coming back to the present day. Is that correct? So you take this revenue stream and look at it, what it would be in 2018, and then you back that out at 10% less value per year, and then that's what that meaning is, right?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's exactly right. We're looking at both at the profits as well as the investments, because the investments occur before the profits, they get discounted less. But you're exactly right. The way these discount rates work is they compound, and it's a 10% annual discount rate.
Okay, thank you.
In the event of a 50% cost overrun, that is the project costs more than $30 billion into Alberta, what we see is that the net present value of the project falls. Whereas before, I think we were looking at $12.1 billion at $5.50 gas. Here, we're looking at $9.2 billion. So you can see that cost overrun risk is real on the project. It matters. Internal rates of return are still quite high, significantly above these companies' hurdle rates, typically. Profitability ratios are still quite high. Now, these numbers, again, are numbers based on producers' upstream returns. We're assuming here that the producers own and invest in the gas treatment plant. We are assuming that the gas treatment plant is not subject to PPT credits or deductions. We are also assuming that producers invest in all of the necessary upstream investment for Point Thompson, associated pipelines, but not in the pipeline itself, not in the pipeline project. And as we'll see in the next slide, it makes a very big difference to what these investment numbers look like.
Representative Johnson?
I want to clarify. Did you say that does take into consideration that this does include infrastructure for the field or does not?
It does include field infrastructure, but it does, and it assumes that the producers do invest in the gas treatment plant, that they own it and they invest in it. But in our modeling, we are also assuming that the gas treatment plant, as we read the PPT, the gas treatment plant is not a deductible expense for PPT purposes. So that's how we're modeling it. And I know there's some issue about it, but I wanted to clarify the assumptions that we're making here.
Just to step back on the assumption, how did you value the cost of their expansion? I mean, of their infrastructure. I mean, did you pick a dollar amount? Did you use past history when you included that in there? What how did you figure that number of what it's going to cost them to expand?
Yeah, we know based on both conversations with the producers and our understanding of the Prudhoe Bay field, for example, that the incremental infield investments that are required at Prudhoe Bay will be relatively modest. I mean, there are lots of wells there already. They're producing gas today on the order of 8 BCF a day. The gas is being transported by feeder pipelines. So most of the Prudhoe Bay infield infrastructure is already in place. We assume small quantities of incremental investment within Prudhoe Bay, except, of course, for the gas treatment plant.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
$2 billion? $1 billion?
The gas treatment plant, the cost estimate, which is a public number from the producer's 2001 study, I think was on the order of $2.3 billion in 2001 dollars. Again, the cost of the gas treatment plant, we scaled up to reflect the change from a $20 billion project to Chicago to a $30 billion project, which is the most recent number being floated around, to Chicago. So it's been increased by roughly 50%.
That's included in the $30 billion and the $20 billion? Or
yes, it is.
Included?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Seaton?
Thank you. On the left-hand side, we have the $4, $5.50, and $7, but I don't see any talk of the tariff.
Right. The tariff here is assumed to be established on the the parameters that determine the tariff are listed in the back. There, we assume a 70-30 capital structure. It may be more leveraged than that, which would improve the returns, but we don't go there. We assume a 14% return on equity. It may well be less than that, but again, we just take 14%. And the cost of debt, I think, I'm quite sure, is 6.5%. Roll those all together, and not including fuel use, you're looking at a tariff of about $2, $1.96. But you're right in the $2 range.
What's the tariff if you're going to liquefy gas and put it on a boat and then regasify it? Is that also $2 or?
I couldn't tell you sitting here today.
Right.
this slide, slide five, shows producers' returns as both shippers and pipeline owners. That is, they're investing in both the pipeline and the upstream. So the investment here is much bigger, and the investment is upfront over a long period of time. And what one sees is very dramatic. If you contrast this with slide three, very substantial declines in internal rates of return, in profitability index. The net present value has actually also declined. The reason for the decline in net present value is because the tariff off of the pipeline throws off a return of about 8.5% on a weighted average cost of capital basis, whereas the discount rate is greater than that. And so basically, investing in the pipeline at a 10% discount rate costs you money. Again, that's just how the numbers work out. If you have a low enough discount rate, why the pipeline doesn't cost you money. But in general, 10% is it is not a particularly low discount rate for an oil and gas company. Pipeline companies have different discount rates. They have different risk profiles, different appetites for risk. They will use a different discount rate. It'll be a lower discount rate. They'll find a pipeline investment attractive. But in any case, what we see here is a decline in the investment measures pretty much across the board.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Well, from what you've just showed us, it would seem, if this is factual, that the shippers wouldn't want to be owners of the pipeline.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's an extremely interesting and provocative question, which I'd like to turn to in a couple minutes.
Okay.
This slide here shows the distribution of net present value, both from an integrated and upstream investment only perspective. It's showing a relative frequency distribution, whereas the previous slides said, well, at a $3.50 gas price or a $5.50 gas price or a $7 gas price, assume it was constant, held the same for each and every year for 30 years of gas flow, those are what the returns would be. Of course, gas prices change significantly from one day to the next. Nobody expects the gas price to stay the same each and every day for 30 years. So it's, you know, the previous slide give you an indication. This slide shows the relative likelihoods of different outcomes. And what you see here is that we believe that from an upstream-only investment perspective, half of the time, if you look at the blue bar, half of the time the net present value discounted at 10% would be at least $13 billion. That is, there's at least a 50% likelihood that the net present value will be at least $13 billion. There's also a 50% likelihood that it would be below. The further you stray away from that $13 billion number, the less likely the outcome is. So this just gives you a sense of sort of relative likelihood of different outcomes. So there's a small chance that returns off the project will exceed $30 billion. There's not a lot of probability mass on that tail way out there.
Question.
Oh, sorry, Representative Roses.
Let me go back to the point that you said at the $13 billion. So there's 50% likelihood that it'll be above and a 50% likelihood it'll be below. Well, what other percentage would there be? It either is or it isn't below. I don't get that. I mean, it's a 50-50 chance. Yes, it is or no, it isn't.
Representative Roses, through the chair, if one were to, for example, again, look at the blue line, and look at returns at $6 billion. The likelihood that returns off the project would exceed $6 billion. What this diagram explains is that the likelihood of that event is considerably greater than 50%. In fact, the likelihood of that would exceed 75%. I'm just eyeballing it.
Sure.
So those lines there are drawn at the 50% level, just for point of reference, because it's pretty hard to integrate probabilities by eye. The next slide shows the relative frequency distribution of internal rates of return. On the upstream, we see a median likelihood, a median IRR of about 57%. That means it's 50% likelihood that internal rate of return on an upstream investment basis only would be 57%. If contrast that with an integrated project, the spread is much narrower. It's much more tightly clustered. The probability of internal rates of return approaching 57% is essentially zero. Again, the reason here is you've got an enormous upfront investment in the pipeline, and it drags the internal rate of return down. Similar frequency distributions here for on slide 8 for profitability index. That's sort of the general context of what producer returns from this project look like. And I'm going to come back to your question, don't worry. So let's put this in context of their other opportunities worldwide, investment opportunities. Now, this slide is basically lifted from an Econ 1 presentation to the LB&A committee in June 14th of last year. What Econ 1 did is they corrected for a couple of mistakes that were made by consultants to the former administration looking at comparative project investments. And these are the data. So if you look at the three producers and you look at the investment opportunities on their books, each little triangle or each little square there represents an investment opportunity with an associated net present value on this slide. And the net present values differ, of course, at different prices. So if you've got a higher oil price, a $35 oil price, you get higher net present value than if you have a lower oil price, $25 price. They're the same projects, just evaluated here at different prices. But again, each little dot here is a potential project that could be invested in with net present value returns. What was done here is they were all just stacked up and ordered. And so the very worst project on this list is in the far right-hand corner. And in fact, you've got a net present value at 10% on the worst project, which is actually negative. It dips down below the axis a little bit. That's a project, even if you were not capital constrained, you would not invest in no matter what. Because if your discount rate were 10%, if you were to invest in it, it would reduce the value of your firm. Essentially, all of the other projects, though, just about, add value to the firm. They all have positive net present value, and they all add value to the firm. Clearly, the projects that are furthest to the left are the most attractive. They add the most value to the firm. So the projects that are furthest to the left are the ones you want to invest in the most on a net present value basis. This is the same slide. And what we're showing here is the Alaska project under the 2005 fiscal terms. So this is under ELF. This is pre-Murkowski contract returns. And what it shows is that either for a project which terminates in Alberta or for a project that terminates in Chicago, the Alaska project is the most attractive project in the portfolio. It provides, on an NPV basis, provides the biggest value to the firm. What one sees is significant spread in net present value between Alberta and Chicago, it's material spread between those two. You look at the big diamond, for example, in the red. Mm-hmm. You look at the red, you see the big diamond there. It moves from, if you're terminating in Chicago, from around, I'd guess, $8 billion NPV. If you're terminating in Alberta, it moves up, and it's on the order of nearly $10 billion NPV. And again, the reason why there's a difference there is because if you terminate in Alberta, there's less investment, significantly less. You're traveling a lot less far. We can come back and talk about project terminating in Alberta versus Chicago in a little bit. So this is the same slide, and what I've done here is I've added in, under the current fiscal terms, not under ELF, but under PPT, the net present value of the Alaska project, both from an upstream-only perspective, those are the solid green circles, and an integrated upstream-midstream perspective, and those are the speckled green circles. And what one sees is that the effect of PPT and the effect of significantly higher project costs, because now we're assuming about $20 billion into Alberta, and before we were assuming more like 15, actually it's a little bit less than that. I think it was more like $13 billion into Alberta. NPV drops. Also, NPV drops because the state share of the revenue off of the project under PPT has gone up. But what one still sees is comparing these numbers here in slide 10 with the numbers in slide 11 is that the Alaska project, from an upstream perspective, is still either the first or second most attractive project in the portfolio. From an upstream, midstream, integrated perspective, it's dropped down to maybe the third most attractive project in the portfolio. Again, from an NPV perspective.
But
Representative Wilson?
But at this one, it's assuming that they don't own any ownership in the pipeline, but in this one, they had 100% ownership.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, in slide 11, I show both cases. I don't go to Chicago in either case, but I'm looking at a project which terminates in Alberta. The solid green circles represent upstream investment only. They don't own the pipe. The speckled green circles represent integrated upstream midstream project investment.
All right, gotcha. I was reading what it said on the bottom of the slide.
Yes, right. The upstream return data assumes 0% pipeline ownership. That's what we mean by upstream only. So the next slides, rather than sort of walking you through piece by piece how that, this just provides for profitability ratios. And what you see is that from an upstream perspective only, the Alaska project is by far the most attractive profitability index ratio investment in the portfolio. In fact, it doesn't fit on the chart. From an integrated, we own the pipeline perspective, however, it's significantly, it's at roughly the 25th percentile. That is, there are roughly three-quarters of the investment opportunities in the portfolio are more attractive. And here we can see the material effects on profitability index, again, of two things. One, increasing costs, but importantly as well, you can see it by comparing the Chicago and then green speckled returns. what you're really looking at there in terms of the decrease in profitability index is the effect of the change from ELF to PPT. And that really shows up actually at Prudhoe Bay, because before we were looking at an effective tax rate at Prudhoe Bay of, I don't know, 7.5%, something like that. The current effective tax rate at Prudhoe Bay on gas under PPT, because there isn't lots of marginal investment in the field, other than the GTP, is much higher. I mean, it's now on the order of 20%. So this is, again, just looking at internal rates of return. We're seeing a similar dynamic. There's a huge swing between whether you also own the pipeline under PPT versus not. If you don't own the pipeline, however, in terms of internal rates of return, this is a very attractive project in the portfolio. So we're finally ready to get back to the question Representative Wilson asked, which is, why do the producers want to own the pipeline? Mm-hmm. There are a number of possible answers. One of the answers that I've heard in the building is the contention that the producers, it's not that they necessarily want to own the project, but they have to, because they're the only companies that can build it. They're the only companies that can finance it. I don't know how to say this politely, but it isn't so. You've heard from pipeline companies who are ready, willing to invest in the project. They can handle it. They can do this. They do require, of course, firm transportation shipping commitments. And I'll get to why they need those in a minute. But it's extremely important to recognize what provides the financing for this project. It is not Exxon's balance sheet. Exxon won't put its balance sheet at risk on this project. There's no need to. The financing community wouldn't ask them to. This project will be financed on a project finance basis. And what that means is that the expected revenues off of the project will be the basis for lenders providing debt to the project. It's the gas in the ground that matters. If there weren't gas in the ground, proved reserves, this project would be deeply challenged, but there are. There's enough gas in the ground to keep the project full with no decline for at least 15 years. That's actually an exceptionally unusual circumstance for a basin opening project like this. Again, it's the gas in the ground that provides the financing. If one looks at there was a Congressional Budget Office note when the loan guarantees, federal loan guarantees, were being debated in Congress and whether they should be extended. And so there was an assessment of the value, the likely cost to the federal taxpayers of those loan guarantees. And the CBO concluded that they looked at the language in the federal authorizing statute and noted that the authorizing statute prevents the Department of Energy from requiring firm transportation commitments on the project as a condition of extending the loan guarantees. That's a very big deal, because what it says is that the federal government, if the project developer wants them to, and again, subject to congressional appropriation at the end of the day, but at the end of the day, the project is sufficiently attractive from a credit perspective that the federal government will back this. And their analysis, they said, that without firm shipping transportation commitments, the project would be rated, again, on a project finance basis, double B, instead of triple B, investment grade. And so the analysis of the cost of the loan guarantees was handled on that basis. But again, what's important to stress is it's the gas in the ground which is providing the financing. And there's the expectation, of course, that the gas in the ground will be valuable. And we'll come back to that in a little bit.
Representative Wilson?
I just want to make sure I understand what you said. So you're saying that even without firm transportation commitments, they could still get the loan?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's exactly what I'm saying. Now, an independent pipeline developer needs a firm shipping transportation commitment from the producers to go forward with a project. Why? They do need it. The reason why they need it is very simple. If they put their equity into the project, and it's a minimum of 20%, so we're talking on a $20 billion project on the order of $4 billion worth of equity. This is a lot of money. And they build the pipeline and say, you don't need firm shipping transportation commitments, right? So I'll just build the project, invest my equity, and then, because I'm pretty confident that netback prices are going to be positive and you'll put your gas into the pipeline. The risk that a pipeline developer faces is on day one, they say, okay, we're ready. And if I'm BP, the sensible commercial behavior for me is when I know you have debt service, is to say, your tariff's too high. And they say, well, I had a $2 tariff, but okay, a $1.90. And they say, no, your tariff's too high. Okay, all right, a $1.85? No, your tariff's too high. You put the shippers in a position of tremendous commercial leverage to essentially squeeze out all of the equity value from the project. That's why a pipeline developer absolutely has to have shipping commitments. It's because of what we call holdup risk. So the producers are not the only entities that can build this project. I mean, the representation's been made that, oh, the project's too big for even Exxon. Well, Exxon's sitting on $30 billion worth of cash right now. They could sign a check, all equity.
Is it conversely true that if you were a producer and a pipeline owner, you would say, the tariff is too low?
Mr. Chairman, not necessarily, no. I mean, as we all know on TAPS, for an integrated project, the incentive is absolutely for the lowest cost project mm-hmm. with the highest tariff. I mean, those are the commercial incentives. Why? Because taxes and royalties are paid after subtracting the tariff. If you own both the gas and the pipeline, you're paying yourself. You're indifferent to what the tariff is. You could care less. The tariff is immaterial. It only matters where you take your profits. Do you take them on the pipeline or do you take them on the gas? If you take them on the pipeline, then your tax and royalty burden decreases. So what's another reason why the producers would want to own the project? Well, there's a desire to control costs on the pipeline. And that is fair enough. But there's two points to make about that. The first is, if I'm going to commit to a shipping commitment and the cost of the project is in some way reflected in the tariff, it's fair enough that I want to be in control of driving that truck, of what that ultimate cost is. And that makes sense. Um, However, there's another further point which is often made, which is incorrect. And the point or the contention that is often made, or there's some confusion about this at any rate, is that the shippers pay for the cost of the project no matter what, because after all, the pipeline business is a cost-plus business, and they just charge whatever it costs plus a return. That is not the modern gas pipeline business. That's your father's pipeline business. It's not today's pipeline business. Today, essentially, all new build pipelines are built on the basis of negotiated rates. They're rates that are negotiated between shippers and the pipeline entities. And those rates reflect commercial transactions between the two before the pipeline is built. And the risk of cost overruns are managed in that commercial transaction. So there are a great number of pipelines, for example, in the lower 48 that are built on the basis of fixed price negotiated rates. I negotiate a rate, it's 75 cents. And I, as a shipper, I'm going to pay 75 cents for 15 years. Set it and forget it. That's it. In that event, the pipeline company is bearing all of the cost overrun risk. It's not uncommon. Now, does anybody expect we will have set it and forget it fixed price rates on this project? Probably not. Probably not. And the reason why is the lead times on this project are so long that there are cost factors that are not in anybody's control. They're not in the pipeline's control. They're not in anybody's control. Because, again, we're dealing with very long lead times. But that does not mean, again, that we're just in a cost-plus environment. What we absolutely expect is risk-sharing to be negotiated between the pipeline entity and the shippers. For example, on the Rockies Express pipeline, there were three different negotiated rates, each of which reflect a different balance of risks between the pipelines and the shippers, and they were a result of different shippers' appetite for risk. But one can expect on this project to have steel price escalators where a rate will be indexed to the cost of steel because, of course, the cost of steel is not in anybody's control. And the pipeline, if the cost of steel goes up, the pipeline will eat some of that risk and the shipper will eat some of it. The precise risk allocation between the parties will again be a subject of commercial negotiation between the parties based on their relative appetites for risk.
Sorry, Representative Wilson.
Okay, now, where does FERC come in? If these negotiations are made before the open season and FERC starts doing this, so do they just ignore what FERC does, or how does that work?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's a great question. These rates will be negotiated, the negotiations will be consummated at the open season. It is indeed in advance of any FERC determination of a cost-based tariff. The FERC does not rule on whether a negotiated rate is in the public interest or not. If two parties have negotiated the rate, that's the rate that they get. That's fine. They don't care anymore at that point. So the FERC will exercise its regulatory jurisdiction only over what they call the maximum or recourse rate, which is a rate which is available to any shipper without negotiation. So it may well be that there are no shippers ever on the FERC established rate. In fact, there are pipelines where all shippers are on negotiated rates. It's not uncommon. The Alliance pipeline, for example, essentially all the shippers are on negotiated rates. And the portion of Alliance, which is in the lower 48, that FERC regulates, Alliance runs from Alberta into Chicago. The portion that FERC has jurisdiction over, you know, there's a recourse rate, but nobody's on it.
Then why are we, a lot of people have been out of shape about the FERC stuff when it's irrelevant most of the time?
Well, Representative Wilson, through the chair, the recourse rate will be important to the state's interest, if nothing else, because it will provide a benchmark against which we may determine either taxes or royalties. So one of the issues that the state faces on a gas pipeline for both taxes and royalties is, what do we do in the case of an integrated project, that is, the producers own both the pipe and they're the shippers, and they negotiate a rate with themselves that is 40% above the FERC cost of service rate? Do we establish royalties or taxes on the basis of that negotiated rate, which after all they negotiated with themselves? Or do we establish royalties and taxes on the basis of the cost of service rate, which potentially nobody is on? So that will be a policy matter that you and we will wrestle with.
How come this is the first time we've heard about this?
I can't speak to that.
Well, I haven't understood it that way before, so. Okay.
So in any case, on in terms of a producer's desire to own the pipeline to control costs, there are clearly valid commercial reasons for wanting to do that. What is often understood by that, however, is that the producers pay for all of the costs of the pipeline no matter what, and a pipeline company has no incentive to control costs. And that second part is really not the case and not to be expected on this project.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Rose.
So going back to what Representative Wilson just asked and the comment that you just made, then it is absolutely in the producer's best interest for us to create a mechanism that has the maximum amount of flexibility possible, so then they get to really play with the cards and the economics.
Representative Rose's, through the chair, I think that would be a commercially reasonable statement.
Anything follow up? Is that enough?
No, that's enough.
Go ahead.
The third point is the point about which you may have heard something already, and I guarantee you that you will be hearing a fair amount about for the rest of the session, is the question of whether a firm transportation commitment is the same as a debt obligation. The producers contend, their view is, their, or at least their stated view, is that when they make a firm shipping commitment to a pipeline entity, that it is, that obligation is exactly like issuing debt. There is no difference. We've looked at that question for a number of years, and we've looked at it pretty hard. Economists, you know, they have two hands on the one hand and on the other hand, and they can disagree, and that's fine. But my view on this question has been informed by what the market views, but the market's view on this question. That is, what matters is not what particularly what some economist has to say about it. What matters is what the market as a whole has to say, because that's what's reality. So when we, when this issue first came up under the previous administration, we, back in 2003, 2004, we had studies done, we looked around, we tried, because this is an important question. It's like, well, is affirmed transportation a debt equivalent? The first thing to note is that affirmed transportation, the obligation associated with making affirmed transportation does show up as a footnote on financial statements, 10-Ks. It does. It's a footnote. It does not go against the balance sheet. So there are a lot of things which are footnoted. This is an obligation. It shows up as a footnote. But it does not go against the balance sheet. But, you know, that's accounting, so let's not worry. I mean, it tells you something. It doesn't tell you everything. The contention that affirmed transportation is a debt equivalent is essentially the same thing as saying that affirmed transportation commitment is the same as a lease. If I make a firm transportation commitment, I am leasing the asset. Well, again, that doesn't really play out in terms of certainly how the IRS views it. If the IRS believed that a firm transportation commitment was equivalent to a lease, then depreciation benefits under the tax law, which flow to leases as opposed to the owners, you give up your depreciation benefit if you're an owner and then you lease it. The tax treatment of depreciation does not flow from a pipeline company to a shipper. So the IRS does not view a firm transportation commitment as a debt equivalent or equivalent to a lease. Okay, that's the IRS, the tax law, that's fine, set that aside. What else could we look at? Well, we talked to analysts in the credit rating agencies, and we asked, so tell me, if a company takes out a firm transportation commitment, is that a debt equivalent? Does that reduce, in your view, their ability to issue debt in the future? And the answer that came back was no, absolutely not. That's not generally how we look at things. Now, they will potentially look to firm transportation commitments in terms of assessing the overall risk profile of a company. But in general, they don't consider it at all. There's a 2003 Moody's explanation of how E&P companies are rated, and they explicitly say, in general, we do not look at firm transportation commitments when assessing E&P credit strength. Now, if you just think about this for a minute, it kind of makes sense, right? Let's think about this, because let's say I'm ConocoPhillips, and I can make a firm transportation commitment to a third party. Let's say Kinder Morgan comes up here. You haven't heard from them yet, but they're a big pipeline company in the lower 48. They're building Rockies Express. They're a key partner in Rockies Express pipeline, and they win the license. And ConocoPhillips makes a firm transportation commitment to them. The day they do that, what's happened to ConocoPhillips? Well, they put a footnote on their balance sheet. How do the markets now view ConocoPhillips' capacity to issue new debt? Well, one of the things they do is they say, aha, in a little while, as soon as you have a FERC certificate, you're going to be able to book these reserves, which means your credit capacity has not gone down. Your credit capacity has gone up. If ConocoPhillips can make a firm transportation commitment on this project, it stands to reason to somebody else. Stands to reason that their credit capacity should increase, shouldn't decrease. Makes sense. Why? They're a stronger company. They're looking at positive cash flows in the future. We also talked,
Representative Roses.
But isn't the converse, and I can see where that would hold true. until the first day that they don't make their transportation commitment. The minute they start having to pay because they haven't put enough volume into the pipe, once the pipe's there and you start pumping, then that starts to tip the scale the other way, doesn't it?
Representative Roses, through the chair, you are exactly right that an entity that makes a firm transportation commitment does not do so on a riskless basis, and I did not mean to imply that they did, and I have slides that go to this very shortly. There are two key risks that they face. The first risk is price risk. The second risk is reserve risk. I'll address both of those in just a minute. They're important. They're material. And I do not mean to imply that you can just make this firm transportation commitment and all is, you know, roses and light and everything's unequivocally grand. On a probabilistic basis, looking forward, that's the strong likely outcome. That's how the markets will look at it. Again, I'll talk to that in just a second. But it is a far cry from saying that if you make a firm transportation commitment, which gives you an option to flow your gas, which no other party who doesn't have a firm transportation commitment has. It's a far cry from saying that there is potential risk associated with that firm transportation commitment and with the assertion that making a firm transportation commitment is equivalent to taking on debt. Here's one of the reasons why it's different. In general, in the vast majority of circumstances, when you make that firm transportation commitment, you don't pay if the pipeline's not operating. You make a firm transportation commitment, heaven forbid the project's never completed, you're not on the hook for a nickel. It's a big deal. Pipelines do bear considerable risk, relatively low likelihood, but considerable risk. The biggest risk facing this project from an objective perspective is the risk of non-completion. You get hundreds of millions of dollars into it, potentially $1 billion into it, maybe more, and you find out you don't have a project. That could happen. It's unlikely to happen, but it could. Pipeline developers wear that risk. So from an overall risk-sharing perspective, it would make sense, if you're really concerned about risk, is to bring in new parties and get them to bear some of it. Again, also, if the pipeline's not operating because of an unplanned outage, compressor goes down. Typically, in tariffs, you, the shipper, don't pay. You paid for a reservation of the right to be able to move your gas. If, through the pipeline company's fault, you can't move your gas, they're on the hook, not you. Okay. Couple of remaining possibilities for why you would want to own the pipeline. The first is something that's been alluded to some today, is if you own the pipeline and you're a shipper of gas, both, you control the pipeline terms. You can control the tariffs you negotiate with yourself. You also have considerable sway over what the recourse rate would look like. And you also have considerable sway over the expansion terms. And one of the things that AGEA has sought to do is ensure that whoever owns the pipeline will act like a pipeline company. At the end of the day, there's been a lot of fuss about rolled-in rates and the state's expansion terms. But if you talk to any pipeline developer or any pipeline engineer, those are terms that any pipeline company would, if they're just a pipeline company, would be happy to have because they pursue them anyway. Finally, I mean, you can just ask if you look at the project economics from an integrated perspective and they're not nearly as attractive as if you look at them only from an upstream perspective, reasonable minds might conclude that it makes sense to frame it from an integrated perspective because it improves your bargaining position with the state. So next slide. So again, a firm transportation commitment is a real deal. On this project, a $20 billion project, one's looking at total commitment to a pipeline on the order of, and these are nominal dollars, not discounted, on the order of $3.4 billion a year. If you divide that by three, you're looking at roughly $1.1 billion a year as a nominal dollar commitment to a pipeline entity. In context, however, these are price scenarios. The green line represents the revenue off of the project for the producers, assuming a $2.31 AECO price. The state has run thousands of price scenarios, and what we find is that 95% of the time, prices equal or exceed that $2.31 price level. It is very difficult to get prices so low. It's hard to come up with scenarios in which prices are so low. We've tried. We've made very pessimistic assumptions. It's hard to do it. You can, but you only come up with them about 5% of the time. Representative Wilson?
If there were new discoveries, would that peak kind of stay even?
Yeah. Representative Wilson, through the chair, were there new discoveries to fill the capacity, the peak would not become a shelf, it would continue to rise. And the reason here is these prices, what we're looking at here are revenues off of the project assuming a price, but the prices are real prices. That means they're expressed in today's dollars. So if you wanted to know the price in 2030, you would have to account for what we're using as a 2% inflation rate, so 2% compounded for a number of years. And so that's why those prices continue to rise. But that's an important point, because the tariff is not a real tariff. It's a nominal dollar tariff. So it's a $2 tariff, period. So the value to you, 15 years of operation in, of that $2 tariff, you know, the cost to you, is much less than in the beginning. So the blue line represents 85% likelihood. Again, what that means is that 85% of the time we expect prices to exceed that level. That is, we think there's an 85% likelihood that AECO prices will exceed that level, and if they do, one sees considerable positive cash flow off the project. And again, what we're showing here in this slide is both price risk and reserve risk. We are assuming here that the producers discover no new reserves. So this puts the price and reserve risk in context. It's real. I'm not saying it's not real. It is. But it's important to put it in context.
Let me ask, the producers are looking for reserves. They discover no new reserves. They have costs, exploration costs. Is there somehow they can recover those exploration costs?
Presumably, given an appropriate price of gas, they recover them in the market price.
What I mean is they don't find any.
Oh, if they don't find any, then they're out of pocket. Absolutely.
A separate issue than the gas they're putting in the pipe.
That's correct.
Thank you. Representative Seaton.
Thanks. I mean, they're out of pocket for basically 60% of it, right? Because we're picking up on exploration, and I mean, we get 20%, 22.5% PPT, so that's 22.5%, and there's 20% capital credit, so you'd have 42% that the state would pick up under our current PPT formulation.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that's exactly right, under the current PPT.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. The next set of slides go to the issue of fiscal certainty. There are a lot of data on this slide. I apologize for not trimming it down some. But again, on the far left-hand column, I'm showing real prices in today's dollars. And the assumption there on any given price, for example, $6, is at a $6 real price, you assume that the price each and every year would remain at $6, increasing with inflation at 2%. And again, at say $6, you're looking at upstream. Again, these are only upstream results. Upstream returns of $13.1 billion. If one assumes that at the beginning of the project life, the state were to increase taxes by 15%, in other words, we would raise the PPT from 22.5% to an additional 3 percentage points, so 26% roughly, 26%, that would reduce the NPV from $13.1 billion to $12.5 billion. Again, this is assuming no fiscal certainty and the tax increase goes in on day one. If you assume a 30% tax increase, which would increase the PPT rate on gas by about 7%, so we'd be nearly 30% tax rate on gas, the NPV of the project would go from 13.1 to 11.8. If we were to increase the tax rate by 50% on day one of the project, the NPV would go from 13.1 to 10.9. Now, these are material changes in the net present value of the project. So that the right-hand three columns show the percentage change associated with each of these tax increases compared to the baseline of a 0% tax increase. And so, again, we're looking at, you know, a 15% tax increase would change net present value on the project by about 5%. 10%, 17%, as you read across there. Again, this is material. It's important, however, to put this in context. If you'll indulge me, compare at a $6 price, net present value with no change in tax rate, you're looking at $13.1 billion. Now look at a 30, well, needs to be a little bit more. Look at a 30% tax increase. A 30% in tax increase would reduce the NPV from $13.1 to $11.8 billion. That amount of value reduction is less than a sustained price difference between $5.50 and $6 gas. That is, if the price is sustained at $5.50 gas as opposed to $6 gas, NPV on the project is $11.3 billion. In other words, a 50-cent price movement is worth more than a 30% change in tax. The big risk on this project is price risk.
Of course, that's a big percent. 50 cents out of $6 is 1/12.
It is material. You're absolutely right. On the other hand, if you look at gas prices today, which are around, I don't know, $7 nationwide average, in that range, price moves significantly day to day, week to week, month to month. You know, swings are, you know, substantial. Now, we've modeled, for example, big changes in level of LNG imports. We've modeled cases where the country as a whole is importing 60% of its gas needs by LNG by 2035, somewhere around there. And the swing in lower 48 gas prices between, say, a 10-12% LNG import level and a 60% LNG level is on the order of 50 cents. So it matters, Absolutely. But that's risk that people wear every day.
So we can plan on raising taxes because our tax increases wouldn't be on day one. This, what you were talking about was modeling the increase on day one.
That's correct. This next slide looks at the effect of raising taxes in the 11th year of the project. That is, this is the AGIA structure. Fiscal certainty is provided for the first 10 years of the project. And what we see is that a 15% tax increase makes a 2% difference in NPV, whereas without fiscal certainty, it made about a 5.2 difference in NPV. So providing fiscal certainty for 10 years makes a material difference in terms of exposure to fiscal uncertainty. There's no question about it. The next slide, same results here, but providing fiscal certainty for 5 years. And what you see here is, you know, change in that 15% tax rate at $6 gas makes a 3.5% difference, as opposed to with no fiscal certainty at 5.2. This fiscal certainty is material. I mean, it's a lot better than nothing, but it's not, you're not necessarily out of the woods. For illustration purposes here, this is showing fiscal certainty for 15 years. And what we see here is that after 15 years, even a 50% tax increase only reduces NPV by about 3.5% at $6 gas. The point is that the value of fiscal certainty starts decaying rapidly. That is, the fiscal certainty risk is material out for a certain number of years. But giving compounding discounting, and the investment is made today, it is hard to tell a story where fiscal certainty for, say, 30 years as opposed to 20 years as opposed to 15 years is going to make a difference in anybody's NPV calculation.
And this is not something that the companies don't know. I mean, asking us for more than 10 years of certainty because it's just necessary to have forever, when actually the first 10 years is the most important 10 years.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. The earliest period is the most important period. And it starts to decay over time. It decays exponentially over time.
But they say saving for your retirement, start at birth. It's easy. But start later on and you can't hardly make it up.
That, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly the right analogy. There's no question. I mean, we're dealing with compounding here, and companies do make investments on the basis of discounted value. They don't make them on the basis of undiscounted value. It would be irrational to do so on the basis of undiscounted value. There's no way that a dollar 30 years from now is worth a dollar today. It just ain't so. The next slides show the same differences in terms of internal rates of return. Again, all of these slides are assuming upstream investment only. Internal rates of return really don't move very much with tax increases. So here's looking at tax increase for 10 years. Basically, 10 years of fiscal certainty is all you need or could possibly want from an internal rate of return perspective. Now, that's not to say that companies on a project like this make their investment based on internal rate of return. They don't. After a certain level, and once internal rates of return on a project exceed basic hurdle rates, projects shouldn't be ranked on the basis of internal rates of return, because you can misallocate funds. It makes much more sense to allocate, if you have a capital constraint, on the basis of profitability index. So let's look at profitability index. Next set of slides. we're looking here at absolute differences here as opposed to relative differences that we were before with NPV. And we're looking at roughly 5% difference in profitability index, or a 10 with a 15% tax increase on year one, maybe 10% with a 30% increase, tax increase again year one, and so on. All of these profitability index numbers, however, again, are off the scale from comparative investment opportunity perspective. Same results 10 years, same results 5 years. I'll leave you with these, you know, to peruse at your leisure. This last slide just gives you most of the major assumptions that we're making on the project. We're assuming a 30-year project. The pipeline's entirely depreciated over that period of time. Rates are based on 30 years entirely. And so on. So with that, be happy to entertain any further questions on this material that you might have.
Looks like 30-year pipe.
Well, again, this is just the assumption that we're making here. In all probability, the project life will extend considerably beyond this. But again, you know, in fairness, from an investment perspective, the net present value of gas flows for 40 years as opposed to 30 years, it makes very little difference to the net present value, again, because you're discounting those values way, way out there. I mean, at the end of the day, 30 years is pretty much all you need to get a pretty good understanding of what you're looking at in project economics.
Thank you very much, Representative Seaton.
Thanks. Can you give us the documentation on the FT and how that's associated with the federal guarantee? Or you have the...
Yeah, the Congressional Budget Office memorandum that I referred to before.
Yeah, it said that the federal, if you're going to use the federal guarantee, would you repeat that? I didn't quite...
Sure. The authorizing language in the 2004 gas line enabling legislation, the authorizing language for the loan guarantees says, and I'm paraphrasing, that a project that the Secretary of the Department of Energy may impose no condition on the loan guarantee beyond what the project proponent imposes on the shippers. And what that means, of course, is that if the project proponent doesn't obtain firm transportation guarantees from the shippers, the Secretary of the Department of Energy can't place that as a requirement of receiving the federal loan guarantee. So what that means is that because of that language, when the CBO analyzed the potential cost to the U.S. taxpayers of providing the federal loan guarantee, they did so assuming that there were no firm transportation commitments. I mean, we have to remember, after all, TAPS was built without firm transportation commitments. It's just a big gathering line, right? I don't mean to be flip, because, of course, the margins in terms of the value of the hydrocarbons on TAPS compared to the tariff are significantly greater in the margins compare on gas. And so firm transportation commitments are important for pipelines because shippers are on the hook, even if for a period of time, a week, a month, a year, 2 years, the netback value is negative. I mean, gas prices are volatile. When we talk about probabilities of prices, again, we're talking about sustained price paths, not prices on a particular day. I can certainly imagine AECO prices at $2 on a particular day. I cannot imagine sustained prices in Alberta at $2 week after week, year after year. Can't imagine it.
Representative Seaton.
So You know, I'd asked somewhat this same question earlier about the relationship of the federal guarantee and the requirement for a pipeline to have FT. And I understand where the loan guarantee is coming from, but is basically the risk then, I mean, if the pipeline would say, we want 5-7 years of FT. You know, we want an initial 5 or 7 years is what we're asking for in the open season. The federal loan guarantee would still apply for the other 80%.
That is correct, Representative Seaton. The federal loan guarantee would apply for all of the debt issued to, presumably, all of the debt that that the project proponent undertook or took on to build the project. And so certainly it would apply to debt service that extended beyond the period of the firm transportation commitment. Now, the federal loan guarantee authorizing legislation is good for 30 years. It's not good for 50 years or 70 years. It's good for 30 years term.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So, yeah, I'm trying to get this square, because this has been a big problem. You know, it says, oh, well, there's this huge, whether you call it debt or whether you call it required asset to get your gas out of the ground. But if we're actually, if the pipeline company, whoever's building that, analyzes and sees that there is going to be lots of exploration, there's some, let's say, wherever it's come from, Shell or NPRA or other stuff, they have knowledge of a fair amount of gas there, that they're, so that once the pipeline's built and it's an exclusive line, they can't, you know, because the...
There's not going to be two.
There's not going to be two. So to get an open season, it would be possible for them to reduce the risk on shippers by asking for a open season on 7 years, and then looking forward at explorers and everybody else coming in, 7 years minimum or something like that, so then people could bid whether they want seven or they want to guarantee themselves more time in that pipeline. Is that kind of thing possible?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, it's possible but unlikely. And again, the reason why it's unlikely for such a short FT commitment period by an independent pipeline company is, again, the holdup risk that I referred to. There will be not just debt service, but also my return on equity as a pipeline company. I mean, I'm only going to be able to pay my shareholders, my equity shareholders, earn profits for them based on my return on equity. Now, my return on equity is not guaranteed by the federal government. The federal government only guarantees the debt that is issued to construct the project. So again, a third-party pipeline company will face potentially hold-up risk. Now, can I imagine firm transportation commitments as short as 15 years? After all, pipelines in the lower 48 are regularly built on the basis of 15-year commitments. Cheyenne Plains, Alliance has 15-year commitments. I can imagine it. Yeah. It's probably not the most likely outcome. I think the most likely outcome is more like 15 to 20-year commitments. And the reason why is this. What you're talking about there really is the reserve risk. I mean, a shipper making a commitment is going to face some reserve risk because production does come off plateau, both at Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. And approved gas reserves are going to come off plateau after about 14, 15 years. And so the shippers will face some reserve risk after a period of time. But they're best positioned to wear that risk. And so in the bargaining over negotiated rates, it would make much more sense for the pipeline to say, hey, you shippers, take a 20-year commitment and I'll wear more of the cost overrun risk, because that's something that I can better manage. So in general, in commercial negotiations, you know, you're going to wear the risk that you believe you can manage better, and a pipeline company can't manage the reserve risk at all. It just makes more sense for shippers to wear that risk. Now, again, what we expect is it's likely that you're going to have shipping commitments on this project probably not longer than 20 years. Almost certainly not less than 15.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And I apologize if this question was asked or answered in my absence. Kind of along the same lines, if we change the debt equity ratio, would that allow for a shorter FT commitment?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I don't think it would. FERC does not permit pipelines ever to base rates on 100% equity. What you're thinking about, and it's counterintuitive when you think about the pipeline world, is compared to your house. You know, you buy a house and you start off, you got a lot of debt, you got a certain amount of equity that you put in, and over time you pay the debt down, you get more and more equity. Pipeline world's a little different. You're going to take on debt, and indeed you'll retire that. But the debt retirement schedule is not necessarily at all the same as the debt retirement schedule that rates are based on. So FERC will not allow a pipeline to base rates on 100% equity. That's outside the zone of reasonableness. The lowest you typically can see is 30-35% debt. And pipeline companies will accommodate that by either dividending equity back to the parent companies, shareholders. So they depreciate both the debt and the equity at the same time. So they return equity, they depreciate equity, and they basically say, okay, it's not owned by the pipeline anymore, we're going to give it back to the shareholders in the form of dividends. Or what they do is, as debt is retired, they issue new debt so as to maintain that ratio over time.
Thank you. And what I'm getting to is, all we hear is, you know, fiscal certainty, and we can't, you know, there's constitutional issues about 10 years or 15 years. And so what I'm wondering is if through the formula we can reduce the FT commitment, at what point it would be acceptable to FERC, and then we've got a real number that we can deal with, as opposed to this hypothetical, we need 25 years of fiscal certainty, or is 5 years of fiscal certainty, or seven. So I'm looking, and I know there's an equation that, right, that, you know, you reduce this, this goes up, and I'm wondering where that balance is, and is there, you know, when we start dealing with that kind of stuff, what are we looking at? And if we reduce this number from maybe 30 to 25 debt equity, I think we're looking at 70-30 now. So if we went 75-25, what does that do to the shortening of the FT commitments? And then would we have a better expectation of being able to, you know, if we even can guarantee any kind of certainty and fall within parameters of constitutionality and stuff? So that's kind of the what I'm getting at. Where's that? Are we at that magic number now? Or is it somewhere left or right of where we are?
Representative Johnson, through the chair, I guess what I'm trying to explain is that no matter what we do about said debt equity ratios, whether it's 80-20, 70-30, 60-40, those ratios won't affect the appropriate period of firm transportation commitments. They're separable. They're not linked.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Now, through all these discussions, I can remember before the open season, the pipeline company's got to go out and get those commitments. But for some reason, in my head, those were just kind of general ideas, because I thought FERC were the ones that really set things. So at this point, you're saying that most of those deals are made, and those are solid deals.
That is correct. Those are contracts. Now, the contracts that are negotiated or consummated prior to the close of an open season, those contracts are typically known as precedent agreements, and the reason why is because there are conditions precedent that have to be satisfied before a shipper's really on the hook. Not the least of which is that the pipeline needs to be completed, regulatory approvals need to be obtained. On this project, I think it will be very likely, because the lead times are so long, that there, if we are dealing with an independent pipeline company, that one of the conditions precedent would be that at the time of FERC certification, that the cost estimates be within the bounds estimated at the time of the open season. So there will be a negotiation in terms of a fixed rate, not so likely, a formula rate, more likely, which shares risk between the pipeline and the shipper. After the open season, we go through a, say, two-year process to get a FERC certification, to get a FERC certificate. At that point, there is, assuming pre-procurement activities have been undertaken, there is a considerably better idea of project costs. And at that point, it is quite likely that there will be walkaway provisions for the shipper, so that if the cost to the shipper comes in too high at the time of the FERC open season at certificate compared to what they estimated the time of open season, they can say, you know what, this is not an economic project, or this is not the deal I signed up for. It's not reasonable.
So they can back out?
Mm-hmm. It, again, this will be, assuming the precedent agreement that they signed contained that kind of a clause, yes. If it didn't, no, they would not be able to back out. But on complex, large projects, those sorts of conditions would not be unusual. There are LNG projects now that are being put together for LNG receiving terminals where people sign up for capacity at the LNG receiving terminal. They sign precedent agreements. And one of the conditions precedent would be that the shipper who signed up for the agreement can make their own necessary commercial transactions downstream in terms of customers, pipeline capacity downstream, so on. And failing that, they can walk. Now, these, I mean, that's actually quite extraordinary, because these are conditions that give the shipper who is signing up for this binding commitment an out based on actions that are entirely within its control. So binding open seasons can be more and less binding. It's one of the reasons why we don't define binding open season. Binding open season in the bill is defined in terms of the FERC regulatory process. So for this project and this project only, there are regulations concerning the first binding open season. That's what we mean by the binding open season. It's whatever the FERC blesses, right, as the approved process. But the particular nature of the precedent agreements that are signed there will be a function of the commercial transactions between the parties. And they're going to work the appropriate risk sharing between them. They're going to work that out.
Okay, can you walk me through the difference in the contract? It seemed like all the producers were just definitely upset about that they had to, when they went in front of FERC, that they had to say that it was going to be rolled in rates. Okay, tell me the difference if the pipeline was owned by just a pipeline company and if it was owned by a producer, because the pipeline companies seemed fine with that, but the producer sure didn't.
Representative Wilson, through the chair. I heard the same testimony you did. Rolled in rates, if you are a shipper and you are interested in exploring, are unequivocally good. if you are a shipper and you are not interested in exploring, Roldan rates are potentially a problem because one's rates can rise. And just as our conversation before about netbacks for the state and the appropriate rate, netbacks can rise, and that harms you as a shipper's netback. If you plan on owning a pipe and being a shipper, then as we talked about before, assuming you've got appropriate distribution rules in your LLC with your partners, you don't care what the rate is. The rate's immaterial because you're paying yourself. So if I'm planning on owning the pipe and being a shipper, I don't like rolled-in rates, unequivocally. Why? They can only hurt me. If I'm not going to own the pipe and I'm interested in exploring, it's unequivocally good. So, I mean, what you heard from parties like BG and Anadarko, who do not plan on owning pipe, and indeed Shell in their comments on the FERC open season where rolled-in rates were at issue, rolled-in rate policy was at issue. Entities that don't plan on owning the pipe view rolled-in rates unequivocally favorably. And the reason why is because the rate differences associated with rolled-in rate versus incremental rate treatment are potentially enormous. Indeed, they are so large that without rolled-in rate treatment, it is, and under more robust price scenarios, it is difficult to see how the expansions occur on incremental pricing. And I'm happy to walk you through numerical examples of that if you'd like. You know, what we see is that the likelihood of getting to full infill compression on a 48-inch pipeline from, say, 5.5 BCF at the inlet to 6.5, under incremental rate treatment, the tariffs rise by about $1. Under rolled-in rate treatment, the tariffs rise by about 15 cents.
Can I follow up? Just finish up. Sorry. Okay, and I understand all what you've just said, but we've got the cap of 15% in there, and I assume it's so that will protect the producers a little bit and also still be a good incentive for the explorers.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, that's exactly right.
So, I don't know how much leeway the producers have, but if they have the 15%, where does that come as far, is it like we're hearing the screaming, but it's just there because they just want what they want? Or, you know, I guess what I say is the 15% very reasonable and very fair for the producers?
Fairness is in the eye of the beholder. We came at the 15% in two directions. With the chair's indulgence, I'd like to actually bring up another presentation. It's one slide that I'd like to walk you through that goes into one of the ways we got to the 15%, and it has to do with the true government subsidies that have been extended to this project.
Is this one we have that time dated 4/16?
I am not
the other one.
Positive. Government contributions. I don't think I've handed this one out.
Okay.
Oh, did you pass that?
Yeah, right.
Okay,
here.
Terrific. Okay. Government contributions to rates. So, what if you look at the the first substantive slide, what we calculate a base rate into Alberta, again, assuming all the same assumptions from the previous slide of about $2. And what we see is that if we stripped out the federal loan guarantee, which reduces the cost of debt to the project, we see that the tariff rises from $2 to $2.10. And that's roughly a 5% subsidy to rates. The federal government also extended 7-year depreciation for tax purposes to the project, rather than the standard 15 years. And if one strips out 7-year depreciation and replaces it instead with 15, rates rise to $2.19, which is an additional 4.3% subsidy to rates. If you look also then at the potential $500 million contribution under AGIA and strip that out, rates rise an additional upwards of 6 cents, an additional 3% subsidy to rates. And if you, you put that all together, you see that subsidies to the project are on the order of about 25 cents. That is, without subsidies, rates would be $2.25 instead of $2. So that by itself is worth about 12.5%. So if one further considers the federal income tax credit of 15%, which was extended to the gas treatment plant as part of the enabling legislation in 2004, then total government subsidies to this project certainly exceed 15%. And so one of the ways of looking at the 15% roll-in cap is a way is to say, well, those government subsidies need to be shared by all shippers on the system. They're not enjoyed only by the initial shippers. We also came at the 15% another way. And that was from the state's interest in ensuring that the capacity of the pipeline, that is, its ability to expand economically to accommodate new exploration and development, was not artificially capped. And what we believe, based on a fair amount of engineering and tariff modeling work that we've done, is that a 15% cap is likely to get us through full infill compression and probably through the first looping of the project. After the first looping, rates will probably again begin to decline some, or at least hold steady, or you know. But you know, that's what we were trying to sort of shooting for. Again, there's uncertainty about the rate effects of expansion, which are absolutely driven by uncertainty about when the expansion occurs. The further off it occurs in time, the more expensive it gets. There are also uncertainties associated with the cost of expansion, because when we roll in, we're also rolling in the cost of fuel. If fuel prices are expensive, you max out on your roll-in cap more quickly.
Okay, and one more thing. Explain to me exactly why the producers are, if they can make that agreement with the pipeline people, if they can make that agreement before the, how come they're complaining about not being able to negotiate with FERC?
Well, what they're complaining about, Representative Wilson, is that the bill requires that the pipeline company not negotiate rates that would preclude it from rolling in expansion costs up to the 15% cap. So, but if the producers own the pipeline themselves, what I fully expect is that they would negotiate rates with themselves, which would prevent expansion costs from being rolled in to them as shippers. At least that's what I would do if I were a shipper and I also own the pipe. I mean, that is the deal that I would absolutely negotiate with myself. And why does that matter? Well, it matters because if there's a subsequent expansion, it will be exceptionally difficult for the FERC to order rolled in rate treatment of those expansion costs, because there are no shippers to spread it over. And so as a practical political matter, the FERC's hands, in their ability to actually roll in such expansion costs, I think, would be affected. Because after all, what we're talking about here, these expansions, you know, we refer to them as cheap, but they're not little deals. The first BCF of expansion, I mean, it's over $1 billion worth of investment in compressors. It's a major undertaking in itself.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely.
Question is a little bit on the unusual side. Perhaps it's reflective of the fact that I'm on some meds from a hip condition.
Where do you get this one?
We're all trying to work in a unified fashion here, and I know the administration is working on this from a team approach here, and all the entities, agencies, departments are working together to speak in a unified voice. It strikes me as just a little bit odd that we're hearing statistics and economic analysis and so forth from the Division of Oil and Gas. And I fully respect Anthony, and we've talked before, and you've done a great job in presenting this information. And you've presented this information in layman's terms for the non-economics individuals on this committee, myself included, to clearly understand what is being presented here and described. But I just want to make sure that we're not seeing any kind of a rift here between, say, the Division of Oil and Gas and revenue, because oil and gas, of course, promulgates and administrates regulations, and it's the revenue department that does the accounting and economic analysis. So it just struck me as a little unusual that oil and gas here, as opposed to revenue. Any concerns for us to be aware of here?
No, I was actually looking around because Marcia Davis at one point, I believe, was behind me. And so I was going to...
She's watching on the monitor.
ask her to come up and vouch for me if she wanted to.
Not what you're saying is correct.
Yeah.
I hold you in high
but respect. The,
credibility.
But no, I'd like to speak to that for a minute. It's not the case that DNR is engaged solely in regulatory activities. In fact... the Division of Oil and Gas has, as a crucial function, a commercial function. That is, our lease relationship with the folks who explore for and develop hydrocarbons is a commercial relationship. It's bound by contract. It's not bound really by sort of the sovereign, which is indeed Department of Revenue's relationship with the companies is as a sovereign. In fact, our relationship in Department of Natural Resources with the companies is as a commercial counterpart. We are, in effect, under the law in terms of contract, equals. As a sort of just general matter in terms of expertise on geology, pipeline tariffs, and rate making, and so on, there actually tends to be more expertise within the Department of Natural Resources and the Division of Oil and Gas, actually, than in the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Anthony, for the very good presentation. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Representative Corey.
Okay. I don't see any hands up. We did this last time. We had a kind of a go around the room. Representative Edgman, comment? Representative Corey just finished. Representative Seaton? Nope. Representative Kawasaki? Representative Roses?
Not a question, but more or less a comment. I really do appreciate the presentation, and I think it added some clarity to some of the concerns and questions and presentations that we had. And I think the bottom line for me is the ones that were hollering the most about the flexibility were the ones that it seemed to have the greatest control over both sides of the pricing structure. So it would stand to reason why they would want the flexibility. And the other part, when you talked about FERC setting the rates as opposed to us establishing the roll-in, also ties into the fact that if at this point in time today, as we're looking at this, they're not sure if they want to be an owner or just a supplier, you would not want to establish what that expectation is. You would want to leave it up to negotiations so that then whether you are going to be a producer, whether you're going to be a pipe owner, whether you're going to be an expander later on, that whole dynamic totally changes according to your presentation. So you want to leave it up to negotiations as opposed to locking it in and then putting them in a box that they maybe couldn't get out of later. So I very much appreciate the clarity on that.
Representative Wilson? Representative Johnson? You know, I was intrigued by the 15% in that it's government subsidies. Basically, we're starting out saying, here's a 15% discount, and we'll let the tariff rise back to 15. And we heard a lot of resistance on why should we pay that extra 15? And actually, it does sound interesting with following this presentation that I'm not sure if that's dishonest.
It's business.
Perspective. Yeah. It's a matter of perspective.
You feel like you're entitled to the 15, and so because you're getting it, it's owed to you, and yeah, you are paying
right
to get back. I understand right. There's that other way to look at it.
Right. I mean, just one additional comment. There is a certain amount of confusion about the economics of what a subsidy is. Just because rates rise doesn't mean just that you were an initial shipper, that you were subsidizing a later shipper. In fact, as an economic matter, it's not the case at all. So long as all shippers are at least paying, and this is, I mean, just forgive me for a minute, as long as all shippers are at least paying the marginal cost mm-hmm. on the system, nobody's being subsidized. Think about it this way. This is a hokey example, but it'll illustrate the point. Let's say there's a hot dog stand, and you love hot dogs, Chairman Gatto, and you go there every day, and this is the best hot dog stand going. And you support this entrepreneur month after month, year after year. And then one day, all of a sudden, word gets out.
But these are great hot dogs.
These are some dogs.
These are Polish sausage.
And then all of a sudden, the entrepreneur is blessed with a big increase in business, and he can't handle it anymore. And so she needs to hire people, open a second stand, and oh, there's health care to pay for, and so on. Costs go up. Can't charge you a dollar anymore. Have to pass on those costs. Demand's greater. No problem, I'm going to charge $1.50. Are you subsidizing those later participants in the market? The answer is no. The marginal cost of a hot dog is now $1.50. The market has expanded. Supplying the market is now more expensive. Everybody pays one price. There is no subsidy. You don't see, for example, the first infill compression is quite likely will reduce rates. Won't necessarily, depends on the cost of fuel, but quite likely would reduce rates. Is the later shipper subsidizing the initial shipper because on a rolled-in basis, rates decline?
Yes.
Well, no, they're actually not. Rates are declining because the overall cost of providing service on the system has declined. The only way that it could be a subsidy is if you believe that as an initial shipper, you have a property right to a rate. But then if you have a property right to a rate, what we're talking about is not subsidy, we're talking about theft.
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. And I just want to get your perspective on this idea of subsidy. We've heard this quite a bit about this 15%. And is your view also that putting this 15% in here doesn't establish what the subsidy is, and that we had testimony the other day that, well, the pipeline should know what a subsidy is and therefore shouldn't propose the rates if they think it's a subsidy. And my thought was that FERC is going to determine based on the facts in the case what the subsidy is, and that all we're requiring here is that the pipeline proposes and supports rolled-in rates, but if FERC determines that there's a subsidy, based on the facts and the, and all those conditions, then they may or may not allow that as to be rolled-in rates. But, I mean, to me, it was quite incongruous that we would have the proposition that the pipeline should make a determination of what's, when a subsidy occurs. And can you just relate to me how, what your thoughts are on that? I mean, is,
sure,
how that would work in your mind?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, just as producers and shippers are commercial entities, pipelines are commercial entities. If you have an independent pipeline, they're going to be interested in growing their business. The way they grow their business is by expanding the pipe. It will be in their interest to roll in rates because it reduces the cost of expansion for new entrants, which makes the new entrants more likely, which makes the expansion more likely. The pipeline company itself has no commercial interest in assessing whether something is a subsidy or not. That's your, I mean, that goes to this, the second point that you made. The first point, which is that the pipeline company under AGIA is merely required to propose and that the FERC disposes, is exactly correct. We are not getting into FERC's business. FERC, at the end of the day, is going to do what it does. What we're doing is ensuring that the pipeline company, up to a point, acts like a pipeline company, regardless of who owns it. So they will propose. At the end of the day, FERC will dispose.
I had hokey examples too. I was thinking, if you know, when the price of eggs goes up, it goes up for everybody. Yeah. And you know, maybe it was because of a shortage, maybe a disease, maybe. Wow, look at the clock. We are right on the money for a 2-hour presentation. And I want to thank you very much for allowing us all the time we could have. And I also thought the presentation was very helpful. Thank you, madam and gentlemen, for bearing with us till this hour. And we'll see you tomorrow as the marathon continues. I will now end the committee meeting. We are adjourned.